elements here that might relate to some of the concerns that people have is that in order to formulate this meta string, we have to think about the Lorentzian moduli space. There's no way out, at least as far as we can tell so far. And I'm going to talk only about, you know, perturbative closed string theory. So for most of you, this is not a surprise, but the usual interpretation of string theory is that it can be understood as describing an infinite set of particle states following, you know, rigid trajectories. And the correspondence that string modes corresponds to particle states, correlation function to S-matrix elements, and eigenvalues to Feynman loops. So this is a correspondence between somehow objects which are defined purely in terms of CFT, conformal field theory. So the definition of string theory I'm going to take is CFT consistency, which include the conformal symmetry, mutual locality, modularity. And the magic is somehow the emergence of spacetime, the fact that these sets of conditions can be also interpreted in terms of spacetime consistency, like locality, unitarity, and causality. And you're so used to this string magic, but for somebody who's not in the field, this is something quite amazing. And so essentially, I'm going to focus on locality here. So now, there is some evidence, though, that this picture I just gave of string as described as living in a spacetime is incomplete. The reason for that is that the string is really fundamentally a non-local probe, and it is quantum. This implies that, for instance, T-duality is a fundamental symmetry of string probes, which means that at quantum level, compactification along, you know, a circle of radius r and 1 over r are equivalent. If you think for a minute about that, this is an infrared UV duality. Such a duality violates the notion of separation of scale, which is one of the building blocks behind effective field theory. So this fundamental symmetry cannot therefore be described in terms of the usual space-time language. Okay, that's the first clash, I would say. The first tension. The second one is a tension that I want to illustrate with the Klebanov-Suskind puzzle.
I didn't think I heard any clash.
Okay, no, it's a tension, I would say.
I didn't even hear that.
Okay.
All that I see is that string theory is a theory which in a limit becomes semi-classical.
Yes, yes. But what I'm saying is that trying to understand it purely in terms of space-time is incomplete.
Well,
or, okay.
That's a generally accepted fact.
Okay, well, that's the question I want to ask. Can we understand string theory purely in terms of a space-time language? Another element for me is the Klebanov-Suskind puzzle. So in order to be quantized, we need to regularize the string. If we take the Lycon gauge picture, in the Lycon gauge, the density of Lycon momenta is constant, which means that dp plus is constant along the string wall line. Now, to quantize this, what these gentlemen have been doing is we try to rediscretize the normal directions, the icons, into bits. And we take a very simplistic picture of the free string in terms of discretization scale on the worksheet, which is epsilon. We replace the continuous fields by discrete fields. Now, each bit carries a unit of p plus over n unit of Lycon momenta, where n is inversely proportional to the scale you're using to discretize. And now we ask a very simple question. Suppose we take the difference between two points here, two nearby points on the worksheet, as you know, and then we take the square of it, and we take this expectation value into the vacuum state, and we look for the epsilon goes to zero limit. So naively, we would expect this limit to just be zero, because this is the continuum limit on the worksheet. What we find is that this limit, this is the limit of an observable in the Lycon, is not zero, it's just given by the string length square, lambda square. So the puzzle is that it looks like as if the target view by the string is fundamentally discrete with this discrete length scale. And the string appears then to have an infinite length. This result is very simple, just follow from conformal invariance. So from the point of view of the string, this is the picture I was originally describing. I discretize the string, and I take a discretization scale, which is epsilon, I take this limit to zero. But because the theory is conformal, this picture view from the field X is equivalent to the picture where I take the discretization scale to be one and the length here to be n. So in the limit epsilon to zero, which is the limit n to infinity, the string appears to be infinite. And this is what has been proven. The string length is always proportional to the number of string modes. The root mean square radius, which is the distance of one point of the string to its to its center of mass grows logarithmically. It means that the house of dimension of the string is really infinite. The curvature on large scale is smooth, is regular, so the string looks smooth. So in the limit n to infinity, the string looks like a regular space-filling curve that fills out all of space, all of transverse space. Now, the way it appears is that in interactions, you know, there's an effective cutoff, which is at the modes are cutoff at 1/(t) time of interactions. So at low energy, you don't see that, but at very high energy, you will see more and more modes, and the effective region of interaction will try to spread out. So this is, you know, in tension with the picture of string as tiny object effectively described by particle. Now, this puzzle is also present in any attempt that was made, for instance, Grossman, Neo, Atiquitin, to probe the partonic structure of the string at very high energy, either by taking very high energy scattering or very high energy temperature. The message is always that at short distance, it looks like you have less degrees of freedom on the string that you were hoping for at very short distance. Okay, so the question I want to address or I want to think about is what is string theory? And here we see that there's different things that it appears to be. So first, we can think of it as a collection of massive particles propagating in a space-time. So string theory is a non-local object in a usual space-time. Now, if we take Klebanov-Suskind seriously, we say, well, it's a fundamentally discrete theory made out of string bits. So string theory is somehow non-local in a discrete space-time. And if we take into account t-duality, it seems to say that string theory is a theory which exhibits at the fundamental level an infrared UV duality. And that means that string theory cannot live in a space-time. So it seems to me that in order to make progress on this question, we have to let go of the concept of space-time as we know it. This is what the strings is telling us. And I'm not going to address that. For me, understanding what string theory is somehow understanding how these three pictures fit together consistently. But I'm going to try to understand or ask the question, what kind of space-time does the string theory live in? And I'm going to focus really on what's, I think, the most radical element of string theory is this t-duality symmetry, this, you know, infrared UV duality that says that, you know, separations of scale is not should not be part of the picture. So the strategy we've been using is trying to reanalyze string theory. We use known results, but we don't try to superimpose on these results the interpretation of locality, and we try to see how far we can go there. So let me talk about t-duality. You're all experts here, but we know that string solutions are a chiral combination of left and right movers, and they are closed in that manner. Now, t-duality is when I change the chain, the sign of the right mover. Here, I'm going to use I'm going to multiply x tilde, this dual coordinate, by alpha prime to make it have the dimension of momenta. We're going to see why. So now, in this dual, for this dual coordinate, the string looks like it possesses a monodromy. And I'm going, you know, here I'm changing a little bit the language. So you would call this object a winding mode. But winding mode presuppose that you have a space-time interpretation of what's happening. And I don't want to commit to that. Okay. So t-duality exchange the center of mass momenta of the string with monodromy in the dual space. This is what is expressed here. Now, another way to see that is that we can see that t-duality exchange momentum density with position density. And if we define the analog in the tilde space, in the dual space, you know, there are, this is the expression of t-duality. It's an exchange of p with q. Now, one of the central themes of our analysis is that this dual coordinate is really a momentum coordinate. So x live in space-time, and p live in momentum space. And another theme is that, accordingly, alpha prime, we're going to think of it as a conversion factor, something that has dimension of length, fundamental string length, divided by fundamental string energy, and it allows us to change, you know, length into energy. Now, I don't assume that this is obvious to you, that I should think of this dual coordinate. So I don't want to think of this dual coordinate as some kind of auxiliary coordinate. This is the momentum space coordinate, and one of the purposes of this talk is to try to convince you of that. And I'm going to try to give several arguments in that direction, why I'm saying this. So the first argument is, in some sense, I want to think of T-duality as a Fourier transform, as a stringy Fourier transform. So in order to see that one way, it's very heuristic, but that's how we can start. Suppose we consider a string state, which is represented by a path integral. So it's a string state in the Schrödinger representation, depends on the boundary field, which depends on this circle here. And it can be expressed as integral of the bulk field and the metric, where the bulk field are restricted to be given by x on the boundary. Now, suppose we define a stringy Fourier transform. So we take this field and we compute its Fourier transform. So we integrate over all x with a kernel which is like p dq, but it's contained, because this object depends on the it's a coordinate on the circle. It depends on the circle. It's a function on the circle. Then I need to integrate over this boundary circle, and the dual coordinate, which I would call momenta, I call it x tilde here. So this is a definition of the stringy Fourier transform. If you do this object, then you can see that the corresponding dual wave function is given by a Polyakov integral. But now this Polyakov integral is living in the dual space here. And there's a shift between the lambda, the string length, and the energy length. So the Fourier, the Fourier transform that I do on the wave function can be expressed as a T-duality transformation on the field inside the wave function. It works also for correlators. So if I insert inside the stringy Fourier transform core vertex operators, what this Fourier transform is going to do is exchange vertex operator with dual vertex operator. Objects that are written as exponential of kx, integrated of sigma, in terms of object that are exponential of I k tilde x tilde, integrating over sigma 2. So since, if we want really to explore this possibility to have a formulation of string theory that allow momenta and space to be on the same footing or to incorporate T-duality, I need to, what I'm looking for is a formulation of string theory where we are allowed to deform the string by coherent states which allow dyonic operators. So operator that carry both momenta and dual momenta. And then, the question is, well, is it possible to do such a thing? Are we forced to have only k tilde equals zero or k tilde equals zero, as we usually assume in string theory? And can we allow coherent superposition of dyonic operator? And we'll come along the way that a condition, of course, is a condition of mutual locality. But at this stage, we're just trying to take the CFT point of view. We're not assuming space-time locality. So therefore, from the CFT, we should look at all possible operators. We should not restrict our choice of operators from conceptions which have nothing to do with string theory. Okay? So here, I want to emphasize that T-duality is bond duality. This is something that was remarked a long time ago by Veneziano. If I go again to this momentum and position density, and I look at the dynamic of the free string, it's characterized by two constraints. The Hamiltonian constraints, time parameterization, and the space diffeomorphism constraints. These constraints, it's obvious to see, they are completely symmetric under the exchange of P and Q. And they satisfy the bond duality principle. And Max Born was the first one to formulate that. He became completely obsessed till the end of his life, that he became completely convinced, for reason I have no time to explain, that any formulation of quantum gravity has to satisfy the bond duality principle, has to be somehow symmetric under the exchange of P and Q. And for me, this is where I started to be interested in string theory, because it's the first time I saw some kind of consistent model that could express that. Anybody that tried to make sense of this bond duality principle before failed miserably on numerous amount of time. So the string is a model where maybe we can make sense of that principle. So now we are looking for a formulation. I'm still at the classical level, let's say, that formulation of string that generalizes the Polyakov space-time formulation, but authorizes me to deform the string by any arbitrary operator. Okay, not only operator that respects space-time locality, but any operator which is admissible in my CFT. And can include any deformation by general dyonic operator. We're looking for a formulation that can liberate. The closed string is a, like a closed, it's like a bound state of left and right mover. But if you want to express T-duality, you have to find a formulation that liberates left from the right. Right, so this is what we want to do. And this formulation that we have, I'm just going to give it to you and not justify how we get there, and then justify on its results, is a relativistic phase space formulation. So it's a formulation whose target field are coordinated by position in space, time, and position in energy and momentum. And I, you know, use the string length and the string energy to make them dimensionless. And I used here, I'm using a notation, so you know, I'm using a notation which I borrow from double phi theory, but I want to say we are not doing double phi theory. The only thing we share with double phi theory is the notation and an interest for T-duality, but we're not making any assumptions that they're making, and we're interested into string theory. Okay, so I hope there will be no confusion with that. So now, as I said, I want to think of this space that the is going to be the target space of the metastring as phase space, the space that unify position and energy. And the reason for it is that, as we're going to see, in particular, the metastring action, in order to be written, you need a symplectic structure, you need a B Lagrangian structure, things which are natural in phase space. And at the quantum level, we're going to see that X and X tilde do not commute. They become non-commutative operators, as X and P would. So the zero modes you know, will not commute. So if you write down this metastring action in terms of this phase space field, you find a formulation that we realize after was already discovered a long time ago by in some similar form by Zeitlin. And okay, here's the form it takes. So this is what I'm going to use instead of the polyakov formulation. This is my action. So now there's two type of term, one which contains d tau, the sigma term, which coupled to a combination eta plus omega, and a term that contains only d sigma, d sigma. Okay, so this formulation doesn't contain any d tau square term. It's purely chiral. Now, since you're not used to any of this formulation, what I have here is two metric, eta and H are two metric. Eta is what I'm going to call the polarization metric. It is a neutral metric of signature DD. Okay, H is the quantum metric. Sometimes in generalized geometry is called a generalized metric. It's of signature, or the Euclidean version is called generalized metric. It's a metric of signature 2D minus 1. Okay, omega AB is a two form. It's a symplectic form here. And together, it's very important for the string that together they have to define a chiral structure. So if I define this combination, eta minus 1 h, it's an operator acting on my tangent space, and I need to demand that j squared is equal to 1. Okay? That's the basic data here. Now, what are the main features of this formulation, which is still classical? First, it's chiral. It contains no d tau square term. One worry is that, you know, by doubling the dimension, I've doubled the number of fields, the scalar fields I've put. So I do have 2D scalar fields, but all of them are chiral. So even if the number of fields is double, you know, what I'm doing is that C left is equal to C right is still equal to D. I'm not changing the critical dimension, which is still 26. Now, another feature, as we have seen, when we do the Fourier transform, we change X and X tilde, we introduce monodromies. So now, in general, the general formulation, you should allow for monodromies in all possible directions, okay? And the third feature is that it's not manifestly invariant under Lorentz transformation on the worksheet, because I've dropped this term, okay? So these three features are three challenges that explains why, you know, it was not developed earlier as a full-fledged string theory. You know, any one of these features is already a challenge, but what we realize by trying to make sense of it is that you cannot just try to fix one without fixing the other. It comes as a whole package. And that's where it's kind of subtle, is that you have to understand these three new features, you know, together. And that's the beauty of the structure, is that one talk to the other, and the structure you find at the end is very constrained. And so maybe, yeah. Okay, so let's try to see, you know, so far, what is the link with Polyakov formulation? Well, let's make a certain number of hypotheses on these things. Suppose now that I assume that eta and omega are constant. And I also assume that eta plus omega is maximally degenerate, so that the kernel of that object is a Lagrangian manifold. So, you know, I can choose coordinates where eta has this form and omega has this form. Okay. Now, suppose again that h doesn't depend on x and x tilde, but depends only on x. So it's independent of x tilde. Okay. And then suppose that all the monodromies, you know, are in the x tilde direction, which I can express, they're all in the kernel of eta minus omega. Okay. If I make this hypothesis, and if I can integrate out x tilde because it's purely quadratic, what I get exactly the Polyakov action. So it should make clear that the Polyakov formulation is just, you know, represent intuitively, at least it should be clear that the usual Polyakov formulation represents only a tiny subset of possibilities that you can express using this formulation. It's also made clear that somehow the previous challenges can be secretly, you know, alleviated. Okay, so how do we recover the Polyakov action? So it means that the previous field, G and B, are all in the H metric, because this is the only object I've supposed dynamical. Now you can check that this constraint of chirality, G squared equal 1, with this domain that disguises this form, you know, imply that the metric H can be parameterized in terms of a metric and an antisymmetric fields, which comes as, you know, byproducts. They are not fundamental fields in that formulation. Okay, and I remember that J is this combination. Okay, so now, okay, you know, the new things we have gained by doing that is that now t-duality is, instead of trying to express it on the worksheet in terms of left and right mover, now I can express t-duality for constant backgrounds just as the map x goes to jx. Okay, and it squares to 1, so this is how t-duality is represented like that. It's represented now on the target manifold, no longer really in terms of the worksheet. Okay, so that's all very nice, but I introduced three new fields. One is H, and you can maybe relate to it, but you know, what is the geometry? I keep saying that this is phase space, so it means I want to give you now a feeling that this geometry I'm introducing is a natural geometry in phase space. So usually, you know, we have space-time geometry, we understand the metric as a geometrical object, the B field, people have developed some kind of geometrical understanding of what the B field could be. So the question I want to address now is what the meaning of the metastring background as geometry on relativistic phase space. And by relativistic phase space, I mean, you know, a phase space P, which contains a symplectic form, a neutral metric, polarization metric, and a, you know, quantum metric here. Well, this phase space geometry, the beautiful thing that first appeared when you start that is that the phase space geometry has already appeared in the mathematical literature. It appears as the geometry of quantization. So what do I mean by that? Is that, okay, we know that if we want to think about quantization, we have to start with the classical phase space and its symplectic structure. Now, if we do want to do quantization, we need to provide two things. One is a star product or a non-commutative product, and the other one is a representation of that product. Okay, so it's well known that in geometrical quantization, you know, in order to construct a representation of that product, what you do is that you give a complex structure. Let me say short that this metric here corresponds to a choice of Hilbert space, and this metric here corresponds to a choice of star product. Here, what I'm using is the theory of geometrical quantization, and here what I'm using is the theory of Fedosov quantization. So let me explain a little bit that for those of you who don't know. So, you know, let me think that I'm in Darboux coordinate, dp, dq. So in geometrical quantization, you know, if I give a compatible complex structure, omega and a compatible complex structure, I'm doing the non-relativistic version now. So I get a Keller manifold. We can construct a complex line bundle with a curvature given by omega. We define H as to be the space of holomorphic sections of that line bundle. And the metric H now is given by omega times I, this complex structure. In Darboux coordinate, it looks like dp square plus dq square. So, and in pedestrian term, we can understand the appearance of this metric from quantization as the metric which is induced by the bound probability metric on coherent states. So h, this metric h is really the metric that results from the quantization, from a choice of complex structure. Okay, so now another result, which maybe less people know, which is an absolutely beautiful result of Fedosov, He proved a foundational result about quantization. He showed that given a torsionless symplectic connection, this is a connection that preserves the symplectic form, you can construct a non-commutative star product. And this non-commutative star product, you know, commute with the action of symplectomorphism. So it's a very natural object here. So a symplectic connection corresponds to a star product. Now, a symplectic form doesn't determine uniquely a Fedosov connection, a symplectic connection. In order to choose, but you can prove that the choice of symplectic connection is in one-to-one correspondence with what's called a Lagrangian structure. And a Lagrangian structure is essentially a choice of what you mean locally by P and Q, but you patch it together consistently. And it turns out that the choice of Lagrangian structure is essentially equivalent to a choice of a polarization metric, a neutral metric. So what is the message here? Is that H, you know, is about constructing the Hilbert space structure. Eta, it's about choosing the ambiguity of the operator product. You know that when you do quantization, there are many products you can choose. And Fedosov says, well, these many products are labeled by different symplectic connections. And a symplectic connection is the same thing as a choice of a neutral metric. Okay? So in Darboux coordinate, as before we had that dsh is dp squared plus dq squared, here the the line element associated with zeta is the form dp dq. And we see that the notion of Lagrangian manifold. So now how do we, the idea here is that what is our preferred Lagrangian structure? Our preferred Lagrangian structure is something which is null with respect to this metric. So a Lagrangian space now is null with respect to omega, that's by definition, but it becomes also null with respect to this metric eta, and that defines somehow your preferred Lagrangian structure. Okay. And if you work in Darboux coordinate, well, the Fedosov product is just going to be the Moyer product. Okay, so this, I hope, explains part of why I think of this target space as phase space, and because all the geometrical elements that classically arise naturally in the geometry of quantization. By opposition of the geometry of Riemannian geometry in the case of Polyakov string, if you want. So let's go back to the model, and let's look at, suppose the fields are constant for a moment, and let's look at the equations of motions for these chiral strings. Here, which are written here in terms of they are linear, and essentially say that theta of x is j of d sigma. So it gives first a relationship between momenta and monodromy. We generalize what I was saying is that the momenta of the string is always proportional to its monodromy, to its extension. So essentially, it's a property that appears, I call it a dionic object. In some sense, saying that this object is naturally dionic. Dionic in the sense of what appeared in non-commutative theory. It was shown there that the fundamental excitation have this property, that somehow their momenta seems to be proportional to their length in order to be gauge invariant. Now, the other phenomena that we have is that we have a soldering between worksheet null coordinates and chiral structure, which are on target space. So if I introduce the null coordinates on worksheet, this equation translates into the fact that the d plus and d minus are really implemented on the target by chiral projection, which I define here as 1 plus or minus j over 2. So this is one of the key properties, in fact, that allow to liberate this notion of chirality, which is tied up to the worksheet, to a notion of chirality, which is now tied up to the target. And once we have a notion of chirality, which is tied up to the target, we are no longer obliged to assume that the left mover and the right mover follow the same geometry. We are allowed to liberate, the left geometry from the right geometry. So this is essentially what's happening here in this simple equation. Okay. Now, okay, so this was the I'm still at the classical level and I want to quantize. In order to do that, I need to understand the commutation structure of what's going on. And there's a bit of subtlety here because of the monodromy and the zero mode. So you have to do really a careful analysis and show that you have proper boundary conditions that define the closed string. I don't want to enter into that. I'm hiding somehow lots of subtlety. But if you know the subtlety, you can go on and find out what is the symplectic form for this meta string. So, and what you find out is that it's so I'm first writing in the symplectic language because this I can do for any background. I don't need to assume that the background is flat. The inversion is easier when it's flat. So this symplectic manifold is essentially, you know, a two-form on field space. So it contains delta xA, delta xB, and there's a contraction which contains the polarization metric eta eB. And here, you know, I need to derive along the one dimension. And the connection I have to use is a generalization of Fedosov connection. So if, you know, if I assume that the omega is closed, which is simpler for any purpose, then what I find here is just the Fedosov connection that characterizes the metric. If you know, if it's not closed, then you can define a generalized Fedosov connection that essentially preserves eta and whose torsion is given by the omega. And that defines uniquely this connection. Okay, so what it says is that the polarization metric controls the phase space commutation. And what we find is, if we assume now that it's a constant metric, we find that x, our coordinate, do not commute. And here we have, you know, eta eB appearing and the usual staircase distribution on the right-hand side. So what it means is that at the quantum level, when we're quantizing, and at the interacting level, the metastring targets appear non-commutative. And this is another justification for the fact that, you know, initially I was saying that x and x tilde are really space and momentum space, is that they're really conjugate variable in a precise sense. So, okay, before we try to address that property, let's just go more classical analysis. Let's look at the spectra. So the vertex operator will be, you know, coherent states of scalar vertex operator. Operator contains, you know, one derivative and two. And now all these operators are allowed to explore both the coordinate x and its dual. Okay, we are no longer restraining ourselves into only half of it. And of course, because of that, now we have new chiral fields that appear. So before, in the usual formulation string theory, all the fields you can write for the closed strings are non-chiral. They contain as many d as d bar. Okay? Now I'm going to have fields that contains, like, you know, which are chiral of the form plus plus. And this one is going to be my polarization metric. Or I'm going to have something akin to some kind of stringy gauge field here. So if you look at the usual argument, and for you, I'm sure it's boring, you know, but if I have two momenta and I take the product of two vertex operator, you know, it still has to be in the spectra. So the space of momenta has to be a lattice. So the spectrum of the metastring has to be a lattice. And then it has to.
In the usual case, you don't need the equal number of d and d bar, right? If you have both momentum and winding.
Yes.
Then
yes.
You have
yes.
Different
yes.
Number
yes.
Of d
and d. Yes. So yeah. Yeah. So you can think up to now. You can think like that, but I. But yeah, you can think but I want to unify this picture. So if it's flat, there's no much difference from what I'm doing, except maybe what you're going to find bizarre is that here now I'm doing generally. So I'm allowing, you know, I'm allowing everybody to be of that form. So, but you can think that k, you know, part of the k is the usual momenta. And part of the k is some kind of momenta dual to the winding number. I don't want to do that because you're committing to a space-time picture, and we're going to see that this is maybe. I want to convince you that it's maybe the not, but I'm not. That's why I mean it's completely standard. Yeah, I'm not saying anything standard. I'm just kind of rephrasing in a way so that's why I'm saying it has to be boring for most of you here. But I have two constraints. The Hamiltonian constraint that says that the Hamiltonian constraint is expressed in terms of the H metric. And the default constraint is essentially a constraint in terms of eta metric. And both of them are constraints that says that these objects have to be integers here. If I use the chiral projections, you know, essentially it says that I can construct two chiral momenta here. And both these chiral momenta satisfy the usual Machel relations, where n plus and n minus are this number of left and right movers here. So what is it saying? Telling us is that the spectra is a double Lorentzian integral lattice, right? And modular invariants, as usual, tell us that the lattice has to be self-dual. Now, self-dual integral lattice exists only in dimension 2 modulo 8, and then in that case, they are completely unique. So in our case, because of criticality, it means that the space of momenta of the metastring is this double Lorentzian lattice of dimension 26. It's uniquely fixed. Okay. I just, you know, here when I was writing the vertex operator, I put some phase factor. The phase factor are the usual co-cycles. I'm just emphasizing them because this is the only place where the symplectic form appears here. It appears in the choice of polarization, mapping the zero modes between the center of mass momenta and the label of the vertex operator. So it has a geometrical interpretation, which usually it's pretty mysterious. Okay, so now the question is, how does one recover the usual string, you know, from this unique object? So the usual string is that the monodromy for the usual string are you know, only in the tilde direction, only in the momentum direction. And the moment because the momenta is essentially the J of the delta, you know, it also means that the momenta for the usual string are only in the space direction. But for the metastring, we have that general momenta contains both K and K tilde, if you want momenta and dual or winding mode at the same level. Now, the usual string spectrum, the way we're going to think about the usual string spectrum is the usual spectrum is recovered if we truncate the metastring spectra. And we restrict the study of the metastring to operators such that K is way bigger than KT. Right? So we take fields which are going to be very constant in the momentum directions and then can vary, you know, relatively fast compared to that in the space direction. So the way we think about the usual locality limit in that context is that the usual locality limit is a semi-classical limit. It's a limit of large quantum number. And it appears because it doesn't appear because these parameters are fundamental, but it appears because you're restricting the study of your theory to a subclass of operators that truncate consistently. I mean, this formulation of the string possesses a huge symmetry group, and that was, you know, formalized by Borchers. To find the symmetry group, you need to find all dimension 1001 operators here. And it creates an algebra, which is an infinite dimensional algebra that in some sense is the simplest. I mean, it's the most complicated in the sense it's the biggest of all the algebra, but it's the simplest in the sense that it contains all possible ones. It contains a, you know, compact algebra, hyperbolic algebra, it contains Heisenberg algebra, depending whether the roots are space-like, time-like or not. And you know, the description of this algebra is that the simple roots in this algebra are, there's one tachyonic root, or they are in L, the tachyonic root generate a compact subgroup. And T-duality can be understood as rotation by an angle pi of this compact subgroup. So T-duality is just, you know, the leftover part of the gauge symmetry behind that. And this, you know, the other simple roots lie in this Lorentzian subset, which is isomorphic to the Lich lattice. Yeah. And the null roots generate, as I say, translations, the Heisenberg group. So now, this symmetry is effectively broken in the usual string because we restrict ourselves to a subset of operators admissible in that limit by choosing subsector. Now, the question I want to address is, okay, what about the effective space-time description of such an object? So classically, we have seen that the metastring forces us to think about space-time as a Lagrangian submanifold of P. So when we look at consistent classical solution, we have to restrict it so that omega and eta restrict on it are both vanishing. And a notion that I call absolute locality is encoded into the fact that eta is a flat metric. So by absolute locality, I mean that somehow the choice of what I mean by x, by space-time, is somehow independent on the energy state. And that's interpreted here geometrically by demanding that this metric eta is flat, which is the case. So this is where we're going to depart from usual string theory. In all the study, you're implicitly assuming that this metric is flat. So the question we want to address is, what is space-time for the quantum string, and what are the effective fields? So we have seen that at the quantum level, the zero mode algebra, if we pick zero modes as just one point on the string, is non-commutative. So in order to understand notion of space-time, we have to take a non-commutative point of view. So in the non-commutative point of view, instead of talking about space, we talk about functions on that space. And we look at the dual space, the space of functions on the non-commutative space. And in the non-commutative case, now the space of function becomes an algebra. Here, the algebra in question is the algebra of bounded functions on that depends on x and x tilde, and that satisfies this, sorry, there should not be an h bar here. I've normalized such that it's dimensionless, just should be 2 pi I delta. Okay. So the space of, now, okay, but this is really somehow the biggest realm where everything is defined. But at the string level, you know, we cannot take any arbitrary combination of dyonic operators, right? We have to take only the ones that satisfy mutual locality. And in fact, I did not emphasize that enough, that one of the consequences of demanding that the constraints are satisfied and modular invariance is that we get mutual locality. That is, all the vertex operators I've written before just follow from the satisfactions of the, you know, from satisfying the dynamics, it just implies that they commute with each other. Okay? So it means that somehow the fields I'm going to write, which are going to be coherent states of these vertex operators, do not live in the full non-commutative algebra. Right? The fields lives on a sub-commutative algebra. So the space of functions on modular space-time is therefore defined as a commutative algebra of the Heisenberg algebra. Okay? So what we're saying here is that modular space-time, this is our definition, is a quantum Lagrangian. Okay? It's a generalization at the quantum level to the classical generalization of Lagrangian. At the classical level, it's not surprising. Our formulation of string theory allows us to think about usual space-time as embedded into phase space. At the quantum level, what we find is that the effective space-time and the space of functions on the effective space-times are subcommutative algebra of the Heisenberg algebra. And this is the expression, you know, this is like a simplified expression of mutual locality here. So let's look at such objects here. What is a typical commutative subalgebra of the Heisenberg algebra? And what you can show is that, you know, typically is going to be given by a set of doubly periodic fields, so a field that depends on x and x tilde. But these fields, x and x tilde, are not usual variables. They are what Aronoff called modular observables. That is, x is x defined modulo r, and x tilde is x tilde defined modulo r minus 1. Okay? And this object, clearly, because this one is space and this was a momentum space, classically, there's no way I can make that commute. There's no way I can make a function of p and q commute with another function of p and q. But quantum mechanically, they do commute. And in fact, this is a property that Aronoff, you know, used a lot. And he calls this observable quantum observable with no classical analog. What he proved is, he started to ask the question, how can I observe the phase of interference? What kind of observable does observe the phase of interference? And then it's easy to show that no classical observable, no observable that you can write at polynomial functions of p and q can. It's impossible. So in order to do that, you need to invent observables that have no classical analog and that measure the phase dependence. And these are these modular observables. In that sense, they are fundamentally quantum. Now, you know, modular space-time means that we are replacing the non-compact RD by each non-compact R by a two-dimensional torus topologically. And this result is not surprising. We know that in the context of C-star algebra, any non-commutative star algebra is the space of function on a measurable compact space. Okay, so here is just an expression of this theorem very explicitly. So it's always going to be, even in a general context, you know, if I generalize this of non-commutative algebra, as I see curvature of the eta metric is going to do, you know, the space-time, the quantum space-time is always going to appear in this general formulation as a commutative subalgebra, and it's always going to be expressible as some kind of regular space with a measure on it. Now, so, you know, usually this is space, this is phase space, this is p, this is q and x, if you want, and a classical Lagrangian, we think of it, well, this is something, you know, a slice in it, that is at p equals constant. And then everything on it commute, and that's the usual, you know, and two different point commute, and we're okay with it, and that's the picture. Now, the quantum level new possibility appears is that instead of taking just a slice, what we're doing here, we're taking a cell in phase space whose volume is h bar to the d, okay? And we're taking, this is the modular spacetime format. This is a cell in phase space. And now the expression of the, so here the expression of the Heisenberg principle is that if you know the position here, you don't know, you know, you're completely delocalized in momentum space. Here the expression of the Heisenberg principle is that if you are, you can be anywhere in that cell, but you don't know which cell you are in. Okay, so all you know is where you are in the cell, but not where the cell is. And that's how you can localize in both X and P by rendering it, you know, compact. So now, how do we see the usual space-time? So from the point of view of space phase, this is what I want to get. Well, if I want to go from here to there, what I need to do is somehow squash my cell and make my momentum direction very small and make my position direction very big. Okay, and this is somehow how the semi-classical limit I was talking about one recover the usual, let's say, non-compact space-time directions. And now these limits, this squashing limit could be done in different way in different directions. And this is how you recover the usual moduli that appears in the, you know, when you have non-compact directions around. Now, physically, we know that we can never, you know, it's like talking about the classical limit ascending h bar to zero, but physically, that's not really what's happening, right? We cannot change h bar. What we do is that we look at bigger and bigger systems. So we have a number n, and we look at bigger and bigger systems. We coarse-grain the system, and the coarse-grain system behave effectively as if it was seeing an h-bar over n, you know. And this is how we send physically h-bar. So here, we cannot really, you know, this is the string length and the Planck length. The way to do the coarse-graining is really that we do a coarse-graining procedure. So the usual string appears when you concatenate, you know, many of these cells together. And somehow you treat it as one, okay? So this is this coarse-graining procedure, a classical limit that makes usual space-time appear. And as I say, moduli appears as a parameterization of this limit. Okay, so we have argued that the effective fields of the metastring are these modular fields, and we can look out for the equations of motion. So the equations of motion of these fields are, you know, we have two equations of motion, one which, you know, I'm thinking more in terms, this is the one, I'm thinking this one is dynamics, the other is gauge. But I don't think at this stage we fully understand the profound meaning of these equations. So these ones, it's an equation that, you know, somehow generalize the usual d square phi equal m square, and there's two mass that appear. And the other one, it's maybe more peculiar. Of course, suppose that phi doesn't depend on x tilde. So this is, you know, this is the usual way you solve these constraints in the non-compact string, is that phi doesn't depend on x tilde, so this operator is zero, and m tilde is zero too. Okay, so you don't talk about this one; you just have one constraint to worry about, and that's it. Here we do have to worry about, and we also have generalized relations that the mass m and m tilde are proportional to the, you know, left and right spins, if you want. Okay, so as I say, this field. I don't exactly, you know, these fields, they're no longer describing particles. Okay, so these are these modular fields. They are the fields that naturally appear as the effective fields of string theory. They describe they describe dionic objects which have a momenta proportional to their length. And we can ask, well, why am I ending up with two equations? You know, if I had only one equation, I could make sense of that theory. But I really end up with two equations. And why two equations? One is because nobody complained about that so far. But what I've done along the way something pretty radical, is that I've somehow allowed everybody to have monodromy. I'm looking for the full expression of t-duality, where I included also time. Yeah. So time is modularized in this formulation, right? Because time is modularized, I really have two Lorentzian direction, and I need to saturate both t. So one direction is the modularization of t, and the other one is the modularization of energy. And I need two equations to saturate these two time-like directions. Now, another reason why I have two equations is that, if you remember, in order to allow a Carroll, in order to allow formulations where you have vertex operator that have left and right mover non-equally balanced, then each time you do that, you're going to break Rothschild-Lorentz symmetry. But I don't want to break Rothschild symmetry. I want to restore Rothschild symmetry. So I need two beta equations. I need one equation that tells me that conformal symmetry is restored. This is this one. This is a beta equation for the conformal factor. And I need another equation that tells me that the Lorentz symmetry is restored. And that's the beta equation for the Lorentz symmetry here. OK, so now I just say that time is modularized, which means that, you know, now it replaces time by a set of two periodic variables. What does that mean? I mean, doesn't it violate causality? So clearly, you know, if I were thinking that I'm just forgetting about this E and I'm just making time periodic, then it would. So, you know, this procedure, it would if time was periodic and we were talking about fields and particles. But we are not. Okay. Now, another thing which is important is to appreciate that when I do modularization, I'm not losing any information. It's not less or more than what I had before. The reason for that is that there is a natural isomorphism between usual fields, phi of x, and modular fields. You can think of it as both of them are Lagrangian, you know, in a quantum algebra. So, you know, I can always rotate one into the other. I can change polarization. And in fact, this change of polarization, remarkably, was, you know, worked in all possible goality by Toft in his reformulation or discrete formulation of quantum mechanics. And so, in fact, Toft, you know, proposed to work with the momenta of modular variable in this formulation for completely different reasons. So it means that somehow, okay, it's not like compactification. When I compactify and I throw the massive mode, I'm losing lots of information. Here I'm keeping all of it. And the fields here, the interactions of the fields are really local. The difference is that the interactions of the modular field are local in modular space-time here. They're local in X and XE, but they're not local in X. That's the big difference. So now, well, one of the main reasons here is that the structure comes from a consistent string theory. So therefore, we expect the string magic to work, and we expect this modification of causality to be interpretable in a sensible manner, because it comes from the string. It doesn't come from our own imagination. Of course, to address these questions, we need. I've given here the fields and the equations, but I haven't really given you what kind of, if there is an action principle behind that. So we need to be able to understand whether we can construct the effective modular field theory behind that and understand somehow independently from a modular space-time point of view what it means. And of course, you know, I haven't given you a convincing answer. It does challenge our conceptions of causality. But I think it's a good thing. I've been around the block in quantum gravity for many, many years, and I've seen all sorts of models, some more ad hoc or crazy than the others. All of them somehow relax one way or the other the concept of locality, from causal sets, non-commutative geometry, ADS, CFT. None of them change the concept of time. And if you think about it, we all agree in quantum gravity that we have to challenge the concepts of what space-time is. But if we do it in a relativistic invariant manner, we also have to challenge the concept of time. And here, the fact that it appears is somehow, I think, an opportunity. You know, I cannot claim I make full sense of that, but that's good, because it means at least I you know, it's clear that the concept of causality has emerged from this string theory, you know, has to be modified. So now I've 5 minutes, so let me talk about things I, you know, very sketchily, about more technical details. As I say, this string, you know, liberates the left and the right mover, and it breaks, you know, its formulation breaks Rothschild-Lorentz invariant. So I cannot formulate it in terms of Euclidean worksheet, or at least I don't know how to do it right now, and maybe it's possible. So I need to understand the formulation of string theory in terms of Lorentzian worksheet. The reason for that is that if you look at the action, where clearly, as I was writing, it treats, you know, asymmetrically time and space, right? And it features the introductions of a preferred, somehow preferred time coordinate. So when you see something like a preferred time coordinate, then you can imagine that, well, I can use this preferred time coordinate to slice open my string, right? And it means that I can open my string into little bits. And this seems to be at odds with modular invariants, right? Because how can it be a modular invariant if I don't have this fundamental symmetry built in? So this was a puzzle for us for a while. Hopefully, you know, there's lots of results in the literature that allow. So the question is whether we can consistently couple such a chiral formulation to an arbitrary genus Riemann surface, right? One piece of answer comes from the Giddings-Wolper result. So Giddings-Wolper says, imagine that you're given a Riemann surface, and then around each puncture you choose one parameter. Think of this parameter as the Liouville mode, like the zero mode of the Liouville mode. So one parameter that describes a local set of scale, or you know, a choice of coordinate around that point, which is just labeled by one parameter, which gives you the scale you're using there. And you need that. So you need to extend somehow the string fields will have to carry this extra label. Okay. Now, if you have this extra label, then you know what they prove is that there exists a unique abelian differential which has purely imaginary periods. Which means, and then you define the time, modular time, to the time, modular invariant time, to be tau to be the real part of this abelian differential. And it means that this correspondence, once you have fixed this constant coordinates around each vertex, is modular invariant. Okay. Now, this gives you somehow some kind of Lorentzian interpretation of the worksheet, because you can use this time and space to now look at, you know, the worksheet from this time perspective. Now, the zeros of this differential are interaction points where the Lorentzian cone doubles. So the thing is that everywhere on the worksheet you have the same topology, you know, as a plane. You know, there's two null cone, one past, one future. But there's necessarily, but you cannot have that on a closed manifold. So there are necessarily points where you're going to have some kind of singularities in the causal structure, singularities which have exactly this form, is that the number of light cones is going to double or triple or quadruple, which means that at some point there's two ways to go from past to future. Okay, and these points are completely, once you give me a Riemann surface, you know, there's one place, it's completely determined by the moduli where this point is. There's no fudging around and fidgeting. Okay? So there's a beautiful work, I don't think it's very well known, by Nakamura, that uses this decomposition to propose to somehow, what you should do is that then, let's look at the pens. So in the pens you have, you know, one, you look at, you try to use this property to decompose your worksheet and cut it along very natural curve, like curves which are determined uniquely by the place you are in the moduli space. So it's a modular invariant cut, if you want. And what happens is that you look at real trajectory of this time function from the point of interaction, and then you cut open the surface. Like here, these trajectories are completely encoded into a graph that we call a Nakamura graph, and they tell you how to decompose your Riemann surface in terms of strips. Okay, what has been proven first by Nakamura, and we extended this result, is that this Nakamura graph encodes this decomposition and gives a very, very effective cell decomposition of moduli space. Very effective in the sense it's way fewer cells than Penner decomposition, for instance, and very efficient calculations of orbifold Euler characteristics. So you can convince you that it's way more efficient if you want to somehow tessellate moduli space to use that object. And it suggests that these Nakamura graphs are natural Feynman graphs for the closed string. Okay, so just before concluding, I want to talk about this idea that naturally emerged. In order to make sense of the metastring, we have to extend this notion of RG. So RG is usually that you have only one scale and you flow only one scale. Here, because our chiral theory cannot be weak rotated, and in fact, in any theory where time and space you know, will be on non-equal footing, you cannot cut off your theory with one cutoff. You need two cutoffs, at least. One that cut off the energy, and one that cut off the momentum. Which means that, you know, if you have a flow in a fundamentally Lorentzian regime, you really need to flow in this two-parameter space. Now, in two-dimensional conformality theory, so I don't know the general theory about that, but in 2D it's more precise, because in 2D conformality theory, it's clear that Lorentz transformation and conformal transformation are on the same footing, right? If I take a metric and I decompose it into E plus and E minus, so somehow I separate the left and right moduli, then, you know, phi will label a conformal transformation, and it acts diagonally on E plus and E minus, and theta is a Lorentz transformation, and it acts anti-diagonally. But defined like that, it looks like, you know, restoring Lorentz and conformal transformation looks like restoring conformal transformation on the left mover and conformal transformation on the right mover independently from each other. So even, and this is the beauty of the quantization of 2D CFT, is that even if the action I wrote, I take, let's say, my the flat space action, which is Polyakov, and then I know it's effectively Lorentz. Now I perturb it by something that contains the delta eta. And if I perturb it by something that contains delta eta, it's not manifestly Lorentz invariant. But if delta eta satisfy these equations, then even if it looks classically non-Lorentz invariant, it is, at a quantum level, perfectly Lorentz invariant. It means that there's a way to reach theories which are Lorentz and conformal invariants that you will never be able to reach by a flow which sits purely in the non-chiral sector. Okay, so it opens up all sets of new possibility of finding backgrounds and finding how two backgrounds that look very different are related. So here in this example, the conformal invariance tells you that the eta perturbation has to be a massless field. Okay, and this now the Lorentz invariant conformation tells you that the delta eta field has to have this kind of satisfy these equations of motion. And of course, we are actively looking right now for the nonlinear generalization, which will be generalization of Einstein equation. So to conclude, we have given a reformulation of string theory that generalizes the concepts of causality and locality and incorporates t-duality. It also provides a specific quantum version of space-time. This formulation process deeply with the geometry of quantization, Fedosov and geometric quantization, and exhibit a large symmetry algebra, the double of the Monsterly algebra, which is the gauge symmetry algebra of, you know, behind all these backgrounds. It integrates lots of recent or new ideas recently developed, like generalized geometry, non-commutative theory, relative locality, Nakamura strips, modularity of space-time, and double RG flow, and we are looking at a generalization for Einstein equations for the modular space-time. And, you know, there are things we haven't been doing. I haven't talked about the dilaton so far, so we haven't talked about how the dilaton, you know, plays along. And I don't know today what is really this, if there is an action principle. I mean, one of the mysteries of string theory is that all these equations of motion that you get, not one of the mysteries, but something which has been proven later, is that all these equations you get comes from one effective action, right? And you can prove that order by order in alpha prime. It's not clear that this is the same here, especially I'm not sure how to think about the effective description there. And I want to say a little word of tribute to Max Born. I mean, Max Born was the mentor of Heisenberg, Dirac, Pauli, and Jordan, and he was the co-discoverer of quantum mechanics and quantum field theory. And then by the end of his life, he became obsessed with this idea that quantum gravity would make sense only if it satisfied the bond duality principle, and spent the last 20 years of his life, you know, mostly ignore in isolation thinking about this idea. So, and I think he's an absolutely fabulous physicist, which is underappreciated or recognized. So anyway, thank you. If you have two?
If you don't, one of the things might be very hard to find simultaneous C hospitals.
But you're also doubling the number of fields. So I agree, but you're, in fact, more than doubling, you're squaring the number of fields. So. Yes. So you mean whether it's possible nonlinear? We haven't proven that. Then when you do, so what you're saying is that, you know, here I've just given this like linear equation, which of course you can write down, you know, solutions. You know, whether it's going to be possible nonlinearly, first we don't know the nonlinear expressions of these things, but. It's the thing is that we are doubling. You see, there's two equations, but there's two coordinates. So one equation you can consider, you know, you can think control what happened in X space, and the other, you know, control what happened in X tilde. It's not a proof. I agree with you, but it's not like I'm not doubling the number of equations while keeping the dimension the same, which then would be problematic. But I mean, the usual way of thinking about these sets of equations, we don't think in terms of local, is that what we do is we do pariah. You know, one way that was described in one of the earlier, not the earlier talk, but, you know, what you do is that you do a partial Fourier transform, and you take this object, and then you dualize, you do a Fourier transform there. So it becomes a set of integers that you understand as a infinite collections of higher massive fields from the point of view of that object. And then you expect that there is non-trivial, you know, solutions that have non-zero momenta on all the compact directions. So, you know, you're not, right? From that perspective, you already know that there will be a field like that, or at least you expect. But you're right, we haven't.